welcome to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today, as we're here every time we do this podcast, to talk about life, the universe, and everything from a Catholic perspective. And today I've got with me Father Colin Parrish. Father Colin Parrish is a baby priest, a brand new, freshly ordained, newly minted, chrism still wet on his forehead and hands, right? Forehead and hands? Mm-hmm. Is that right? Priest.
Yeah.
Yes. This shows you how much I know about the ins and outs of the priesthood. And he is he's here in the Archdiocese of Seattle. He serves at St. Luke's Parish in the Archdiocese of Seattle. And used to be just a fellow lay guy parishioner at my parish, at Blessed Sacrament Parish in Seattle. But then went off and underwent a spiritual transformation. So now I have to call him Father instead of, you know, dude. He's not a layman anymore, you know. And so I just thought it'd be interesting to have Father Colin Parrish on the show to talk about that journey to priesthood, and not only how one goes about, or how he went about discerning his priesthood, but also you know, how are things going now that you are ordained and doing priestly things. So welcome, Father Colin Parrish.
Hey, thanks, Mark. I really appreciate being on your show. And the I did have an initial question, which shows part of the fact of my how new I am, because I just kind of indiscriminately say yes to everything.
Okay.
But what was your before? And I don't ask questions.
Yet. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
What was your desire for having me in particular on your show?
Because you're the only baby priest I know.
Awesome. There we go.
And that was it. And plus, you're a good confessor. So I liked going to confession with you. And to the audience out there wondering what I brought to confession with him, none of your business. And he can't tell you either, because if he does,
I don't even know what you're talking about.
Yeah, there you go. If he breaks the seal of confession, he's automatically excommunicated, and he can't be returned to the fold except by the Pope. So that shows you a little how seriously the Church takes the sacrament of confession. It's just priests can't screw around with that stuff. So tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, man, I've kind of been embracing, just to start off with, most proximate things first, just the I've been finally embracing the fact of the term baby priest. I wasn't close to it. I just didn't think much of it. Uh-huh. until I realized I do feel like an infant in a lot of ways. Right? Uh-huh. I'm just kind of lost in the fog of being.
Right? Okay. All right.
because everything is so new. Everything's so new for me now. Uh-huh. And, you know, like when you shift this, I mean, I've been trying to, the best I can explain it to people is, like, I figure it's like having a child, right? The entirety of your life is immediately reoriented, and, like, how you conceive of yourself, how you act, and what you perceive of yourself and what you perceive other people to think of you changes, because all of a sudden there's it's not responsible isn't totally the correct word, but you have a charge of someone's life in front of you, and mm-hmm. and it's not really, I'm not at all being pious. It's like, I'm being dead serious.
Sure.
it's being a new priest, at least for me, is totally disorienting. And,
okay.
And I just feel like a toddler walking around the living room, hitting furniture as I go.
Okay.
Running.
All right.
So, which is good.
I remember watching Beckett years ago. Beckett is the story of Thomas and Beckett, whose buddy, basically is a drinking buddy, the king of England, says, you know what would be really great is if we made you Archbishop of Canterbury, and then we could just get away with anything. That would be awesome. And Becket is like, I don't want to be Archbishop of Canterbury, because he takes it seriously. And they make him Archbishop of Canterbury, and the effect of holy orders on him completely reorients his life, and he winds up in deadly opposition to Henry.
Yeah.
And gets killed for it, you know, eventually. But anyway, go ahead.
I have a bright future in front of me then. If I'm learning, maybe this is kind of putting the cart before the horse for the audience, but what I've been experiencing with that about the grace of orders has been, A, it's real. it's deadly real. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is the fact that, especially as an American, but I think just maybe just as a human being, I have this mentality of that what makes my life worthwhile is the effort that I put out in my life to make my life worth living, quote unquote, and that I have to rely on my competency. However, assuming that I have competency, just for the sake of argumentation, assuming that I have competency, it's deadly for a priest to rely on that alone. Mm-hmm. He'll just become a functionary, maybe a really successful functionary in the eyes of, I don't know, worldly success, but he'll be dead. And so I've been realizing that, the only real strength I have as a priest is relying on the fact that I have a sacrament residing in me where Jesus is present working. And that's actually, I've had these numerous experiences lately of really just allowing myself to fall down and to test the hypothesis that Jesus is the one, is my foundation versus my own effort. Mm-hmm. And every time I've been falling down, there's been a presence embracing me in that, as I've allowed myself to fail at something. And that's been leading to some pretty helpful liberation as far as how the sacrament is changing my humanity as a man. So.
Okay. Well, talk about, let's back up to the beginning.
Yeah.
So, you were raised a Catholic, right?
No. I was raised non-Christian.
Really? Like me?
Yeah.
Okay. I did not know that. I thought you were a cradle Catholic.
Nope. Okay. Nope. I did a Pascal. My parents kind of had like a Pascal's wager of a baptism. If God exists, we'll get our son baptized and he'll have eternal life. If God doesn't exist, we'll get our son baptized and we'll just look like fools for a couple hours.
Okay.
So they got, so it was a kind of a cultural, WASPy sentiment.
Okay.
So I was baptized at, I think at Magnolia First Presbyterian in Seattle.
Okay.
But we never went to church. I didn't learn about church until I got sent to school. I went to Catholic schools for most of my life because of my learning disabilities and my particularly obstinate nature personality.
Uh-huh.
And so they knew that sending me to a Catholic school that they hadn't encountered would be the best fit. So that's the first time when I experienced any sense of the transcendent in some – well, at least a formal gathering of – or institution of people – assembly people that experience transcendence as a part of their nature.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it ended up really connecting with the fact that it really responded to my own religious sense, right? The inherent religiosity every human has. And as a child, I recognized there's something real going on here. And so,
yeah,
I was attracted to it.
Okay.
And then, yeah.
When did you enter the church then? When did you become Catholic? You entered the church when you were baptized, but when did you become part of the Catholic communion?
Well, I became Catholic when I was 18.
Okay.
I joined RCIA. I became Catholic up in a little town called Stanwood, Washington.
Oh yeah.
My family had moved up there halfway through high school because my family were homesteaders up there way back in the day. And so we had a lot of extended family in the region there.
Okay.
So moved close to be with them. I was still going to Catholic schools. And I decided that through a very roundabout and strange means that becoming Catholic was at least in some way, shape, or form a good idea. But I didn't care about Jesus or his church for that matter. It was totally like an identity thing.
Okay. An identity thing. Could you flesh that out a little?
Yeah. So think of it like the way that teenagers, as they're trying to find themselves, put on multiple identities. For example, I was in the punk scene.
Okay.
Hardcore scene when I was in high school, and that was kind of an identity, like some kind of grounded meaning and purpose.
Okay.
But I knew that I needed something more, and especially because my family had been shrinking a lot because of no one really had kids. So the elderly folks in my family who I really drew a lot of kind of identity from as far as being part of an extended family kind of clan situation.
Okay.
We're all dying off. And so as that happened, I was like, wow, I need something that's going to give me more, that's going to be more of a stable identity. So I realized
Catholics seemed good.
Yeah, Catholic. I mean, you know, you can look. Okay. I mean, I remember, I think one of the weird parts was, I still think about this. I don't know if this is anachronistic. I don't know if I actually had this thought before my conversion.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember it was out during that time, but Saving Private Ryan, when that had come out, there's this like one 10-second scene where they're in that village trying to defend the bridge from the Nazis.
Mm-hmm.
And they are having the firefight, and there's just this Catholic priest who's in the middle of the town square with bullets flying all around him, anointing, you know, men who are dying in the middle of the square.
Mm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
He just doesn't give a crap, as it were.
He's right. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and I always remember it. And then there are other scenes where there's Catholics who are, you know, their external religiosity was firmly on display in that movie. And
mm-hmm.
I always thought like, wow, you know, like everybody knows what a Catholic looks like, which is a naive thought, but it was at least on point in some ways versus, you know, I mean, not to be too dismissive of our Protestant friends, but, you know, it's not always obvious, externally what it means to be Protestant. And I was never attracted to it because, you know, there was, you know, if you go to church, you know, it could be in a warehouse that's indiscriminately, situated, indiscriminately decorated with whatever. And then, you know, you don't have any external, you know, signifiers. You just have a book, but everybody has books.
Right.
And so it was just, I don't know. I always knew ever since I was a child, like that I needed the spiritual to have some flesh on it.
Right. Right.
Right.
The Catholic tradition is good at that. I mean, it's got, you know, tangible visuals that you can look at.
Yeah.
And go, oh, okay, I know where I am. I remember there's a scene in a Band of Brothers, which is kind of in many ways, it's sort of an heir to Saving Private Ryan.
Yeah.
It was produced by Tom Hanks, and I think Steven Spielberg had a hand in it as well. And it looks a lot like Saving Private Ryan, but there's the second episode is about D-Day and about these guys in the 101st Airborne that just, you know, jumped out of planes into the middle of this ferocious, you know, massive invasion that's going on. And they're sitting in the planes and, you know, there's Catholic guys there, you know, fingering their rosaries. getting ready to face this this hell that they're going to jump into, you know. But okay, so interesting. So initially then attracted to the church because you were, you know, a young, well, not a young teenager, but a young man, mm-hmm. just looking for an identity. And Catholic looked good.
Yeah, I was actually seriously considering becoming a Jew. Because even, you know, I don't know if they still do them, but at least in the mid 90s, like Seder meals during, Holy Week in Catholic schools were like the bee's knees or something.
Like, yeah, that was like a trendy thing for a while. The Jewish community finally said, could you stop doing that? And it was like,
I know.
We thought this was like we were being friendly. It was like, well, how would you like it if we had like a fake mass at the synagogue, right? Yeah, I guess that would be kind of awkward, right? Yeah, don't do that anymore. But, you know, it was a different time, you know.
It was. I always remember being like, you know, like this is – we happened to have a couple Jewish kids in my class, you know, and I always remember being around their families and stuff and just remembering their I would assume they were probably secular Jews if they were sending their kids to a Catholic school, number one.
Probably.
not to make a judgment on that, but anyway. And then also number two, and them not really saying much about having us do a Seder meal. But the however, I remember their sense of identity and belonging with each other and their larger community. I remember feeling like, you know, wanting to be included in that. And I realized that there was something different about them. You know, that they were, you know, that there was a belonging that they were a part of that was bigger than simply preferences and personal interests.
Right.
Right. And I was deeply attracted to that.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
So, but I decided not to because my mom wasn't Jewish. So, it's like, well, I'm not really going to be, you know, I'm going to be a convert, you know, half breed kind of thing. So.
Complicated. Well, you know, you are undoubtedly familiar with Sherry Waddell, and her Forming Intentional Disciples. And of course she talks about the different thresholds that people cross on their way to discipleship. And so people, you know, they begin with trust. There's something about Jesus or the Christian tradition or Catholics or something that people just have a trust in. It really can be anything, including, you know, that, well, they seem to have a sense of belonging to something, you know, larger than themselves, you know, and then it moves on. So it really can, you know, you're right. It can start off with something like that. And then only later on, you know, do people start going, it would appear that Jesus in some way has something to do with the Catholics.
Maybe that's a super interesting way of talking about it. I haven't ever really thought about applying her five categories according to my own life, my own process. But, you know, I really think that trust was developed in me when I was a child in school because of going to Mass on days of obligation. Mm-hmm. And and also some of the catechists that would come in to our classroom. Mm-hmm. And those crappy little pictures and like Alphonsus Liguori's Way of the Cross. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why I liked those. They were so ugly, but whatever. Mm-hmm. Just realizing like that I felt like totally normal being there, even though I wasn't a Catholic. I just felt totally normal being at Mass and that there was something that was big happening or maybe something that was I don't know. Yeah. So it was, my openness really started to develop, you know, years and years later. So.
Yeah. So this is the late 90s then that you Okay. So then what happened? I mean, how did you find your way to, this sounds weird, how did you find your way to Jesus in the Catholic Church?
Yeah, totally. Well, you know, I remember when, Sherry Waddell was describing in the book, it's like the, hey, y'all, we got to really be real with the fact of disposition versus the fact that the sacrament is operative, mm-hmm. right? Like, disposition matters. Grace is not involved.
Talk about disposition for people who are not up on the jargon.
Also, welcome to having a guy spend 8 years in seminary. You keep forgetting that not everybody's had their nose to the theological grindstone for so long. Disposition means that basically the human heart, right, the mind, the will, the intellect, mm-hmm. Everything about the person has to have a fundamental openness or acceptance of a relationship of a fact happening, right, in order to accept it, in order for that grace, that God's life, God's energy be truly communicated to you. Mm-hmm. So, if I am not disposed, if I don't have a disposition, meaning I'm not really aware of my need or open to accepting the fact that I have need or wanting a relationship with God, right? I could receive a sacrament, and even though the sacrament will be what it is and be as powerful as ever as it is, I will actually not be receiving the benefits because I'm not interested for whatever reason. Right.
Yeah.
And so in essence, the sacrament will have no effect, if only not because it's not powerful, but because I'm not open. And so it's like maybe a more harsh language to say it's an implicit rejection of a gift.
Okay.
So when I became Catholic, for example, I received confirmation, first communion, first confession, et cetera, in whatever order. Anyway, and, I was not open to Christ having anything to do with my life other than having an adjective added to my bio. Here's Roman Catholic, right? Good job. Now I can go do whatever I think I want to do. Mm-hmm. And so, really like that grace is just kind of left sitting there, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, actually, I can't quite remember. I haven't asked this question for a while, right? But that, having that grace just kind of sit there dormant, I don't know if that's a thing. But anyway, at least colloquially, people talk about that. But what happened for me was that I had a particularly difficult, I became Catholic ostensibly, or I mean, I did in real. Mm-hmm. And then a month later, I left for the Navy. I joined the Navy when I was 18.
Okay.
And, it was just kind of super difficult time for me. And I ended up, just finding out, there's a great quote from this, author named Walker Percy. Mm-hmm. And he was a Southern writer he died in 1989, mm-hmm. but, he was Catholic and he had written this book called, one of his books is called Moviegoer. And, he, the main character of Binx Bowling in this said, was talking about the search, right? Someone's who is on the search. And so what it's like, every man must be on the search. What does it mean to be on the search? To be on the search means to be on to something. To not be on to something means to be in despair. Mm-hmm. And I realized after the first year in my Navy career that I was in despair. And I wasn't really looking for anything real. I was, looking in all the wrong places to fill the void that I experienced in my life.
Right.
I'd always been aware that my heart desired total happiness, and which, as Christians, we know total happiness comes through a relationship with Christ. right. You know, as it's mediated through his church, mm-hmm. at least in some form. Mm-hmm. And so I realized once I was in despair, I was just, you know, I got to talk to somebody, and I realized, well, I'm Catholic, you know, so I happened to be going on my first deployment overseas, and, we had a priest on my ship, and I decided I was going to talk to this priest and, just about these life issues. So what happened for me was that I ended up talking to him, after a rosary, the evening rosary that he would do with people. And, I was just totally blown away by this guy. He had something so exceptionally different about him. I don't remember really what he said to me. All I remember is that how he was, probably what he said, really corresponded to a need that I was finally aware of, even if I didn't have language for that mm-hmm. need. So I just kept meeting with him like every night for an hour or two for 3 months.
Okay.
And I, at the end of this process, I had a major conversion where I recognized that I can't imagine being separated from a love like this for mm-hmm. eternity. Mm-hmm. That what this man, how this man was loving me, it was not really just him. There was something more here. There was right. something in him. Mm-hmm. And that I realized that, oh my, like, wow, that's Jesus. This is God that's living in this man. And I can't imagine not being in a relationship with that. And so, you know, I had a really profound conversion experience. I felt like a hummingbird, you know, after, mm. and I remember I had gone to one of my favorite stories about this was this time was I was actually going, I was initially getting court-martialed.
Okay. and,
which,
all right.
Which, yeah. Which they dropped the charges down a couple. It was for hazing. I've participated in hazing, okay. right? Which is like, anyway, it wasn't anything horrible. No one got hurt or anything like that. But anyway, whatever. They dropped the charges a little bit. So I just didn't, I was doing this thing called Captain's Mass,
okay.
Which is a non-judicial form of punishment for the Navy. So I was before all the brats on the bridge, right? Getting sentenced for what my punishment would be. And I had just done like a lifelong confession with a priest, and it took like an hour. And I just felt so alive. And so I went up there in front of, you know, getting, you know, as the, as people will say these days, I was about to get my ass handed to me. Uh-huh. And I was just smiling the whole time. Uh-huh. because I had just got to confession, you know, and I felt this liberation and this lightness and this relationship renewed. Uh-huh. And, you know, the captain was like, you know, shipmate, why are you smiling? And I'm like, and I didn't really realize what I was. Uh-huh. And I said, sorry, sir, I just went to confession. And all these like officers are just like kind of staring at me like, what the hell do we say to this guy? And they're like, okay, here's your punishment. Get out. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, and that's it's funny. I mean, the grace of God is like that, you know. One of the things that has kept me Catholic, you know, is simply been the fact that I know that however much hate, I do get hate from fellow Catholics, it's like, mm-hmm. yeah, you don't speak for God, though. You know, all the stuff that you're angry at me about, I'm taking that to confession. I know that was bad. I'm sorry I did that. And I repent. And God's having mercy on me, and I'm trying to do better. I know I suck, you know.
Yeah.
You know, but, you know, see, it's a strange thing, you know, because people struggle, of course, to forgive, and I get that. But there is a real distinction between the kind of mercy that you find from God, and the, the hit and miss efforts
yeah.
that you get from human beings, you know?
Yeah. Well, and like, you know, for me, like, if I can take that in a direction, like, just in relation to, like, how I'm here, it's like the, you know, for me, the, I think, you know, in my own life, I, after that experience of conversion, one thing was, is that it's, when I'm looking at, I think one of the hardest things for Americans right now, or at least maybe post-Christian Westerners, using big terms, is the fact that, like, coming to the recognition that, like, I don't know, that if Jesus is real, right, the fact of Christ is real, and that it means that it's absolute or definitive, that it has to dictate my life, right? Like I need to submit my life or my heart, my affection before the face of Christ. I have to put my affection before his face in front of him and let him kind of move it and change it and mold it and transform it to become a disciple. I think that's just really hard, especially for Catholics right now in the U.S. in general. Maybe it's because of ideologies that we have that we pick up from the culture. Whether it's like, I don't know, maybe a more conservative or more liberal ideologies that we end up picking up along the way. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the thing that I've experienced is the reason why this is so liberating for me, this fact of Christ and his church, is that I don't know, like growing up and like being in high school and that first year in the Navy, I recognized that like there's really no ideology that's really going to make me happy. Mm-hmm. Like it can only give a modicum of meaning in my life. But mm-hmm. past that, everything gets reduced, right? If I just live on that alone, everything gets reduced, mm-hmm. right? But with Christ, I never felt reduced. I always felt more alive. And, you know, and I found this time and time again in front of, like, people who are real disciples, like, you know, in the ecclesial movement that I'm a part of, communion liberation, you know, community, the unity that, you know, that of people that's caused because of a relationship with Christ that is so definitive that that whenever division pops up, it's quickly dealt with within the context of Christ and that it's meant to be healed and that a unity, an initial unity is so possible that I was able to kind of come to see more and more that you know, that God's mercy ends up having a flesh to it.
Yeah.
And like, I have to, and I'm like keenly aware of wanting to participate in that mercy.
Yeah.
As a witness to the fact of Christ.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. So what moved you? Well, obviously the Holy Spirit moved you toward the priesthood, but how did you start thinking about becoming a priest?
You know, that priest that was on the ship just asked me.
Really?
And yeah, he was like, "Hey, you ever thought about being a priest?" And I'm like, "No, nope." But and then once I just kind of got done with my initial negative response, you know, my response in the negative, it just clicked hard. It resonated deeply, right? I felt like honestly, I think the best way that I could explain the experience was, I remember, actually, I do remember what I said, like, verbatim. Like, there's this weird welling up in my heart. It's like the first time, like, when, after the hormones had you know, kind of finally settled in when you're a teenage boy and you see your first beautiful girl.
continue. You know? Yeah.
And I just felt this deep attraction to it. I was just like, oh, my God. Like, this is how God wants me to be a saint. This is how he wants me to live with him. You know?
Okay.
And this is a method that he has given me to be happy.
Okay. That's interesting. I'm talking here as somebody who has never, ever remotely felt a call to the priesthood. Mm-hmm. For one thing, my wife would really mind, I think.
there's a convent for everyone. Well, anyway. Well, who knows? Do that. Yeah.
Maybe Francis will change all that. Who knows? Yeah, there are people who are like, Francis is going to do – every day I'm hearing from people who are terrified that Francis is going to do some crazy thing that he's obviously never going to do. When I try to imagine, like, if I were single, if I were, like, thinking about becoming a priest, why would I want to become a priest? I think when I think about the priesthood, I'm thinking about it in terms of not so much this is how I will become holy, which you would think that should be like the thing that you should be thinking about, right? but I would think of it more in terms of this is something I can do.
Mm-hmm.
When you say you thought of it first in terms of this is how you would live your life with God, what am I asking? I guess I'm asking, were you thinking of this communally? Because you were attracted to the church initially because it gave you an identity. It gave you a place to be and something to belong to and a people to belong to. Were you thinking in that dimension as well? Were you thinking of this is how I can serve the people of God? Or was it primarily kind of you and Jesus conception of the priesthood?
That's a great question. You know, I'm an eminently selfish individual. And the – granted.
Well, me too. So, you know, that's part of it.
And so for me, it was – appeals, this is like, I guess like I, you're actually hitting on a really, really good and very, a question that has a pedigree to it.
Oh, really? Okay.
It's really weird, actually.
I'm not even quite sure what I'm asking myself. So good. I must be a genius then.
Yeah. You're intuiting the questions of the ages.
Okay.
And this is really insider ball, but there has been a question that's been really important in the church about that came up, particularly in the 1700s and after, about where does the vocation come from? And everybody would say, okay, God, right? Yeah, that's true. Mm-hmm. But is it mediated through primarily the man's heart, the individual heart? Man's heart, like this inner voice, or is it primarily from the community of the church calling him?
Okay. Right? Yeah.
And that's been a big discussion that's actually been a little quiet for the last 70 years.
Okay.
But I almost, in some ways, I almost think it's like a dead end question, but it's still there.
It comes up with whenever women's ordination is raised.
Yeah,
because the way it's always brooded is, I feel called to the priesthood. I want to be a priest, and the question, you know, then becomes, well, okay, but where does the church figure in this? You know,
is
this just you defining yourself? Well, that's not priestly, you know.
Yeah.
So
that's the root of a really good question for my to posed to my own story, in front of my own story. I guess let me answer it in this way then. I think that, and the reason I start off with saying I am an eminently selfish individual is because for me it was, I did not have a conception of the fact that I would, well, let me put it this way. The attraction was, it was that I wanted to propose Christ in a radical way with my flesh.
Mm.
Right.
Okay.
And that this was that when this was proposed to me, it corresponded to the desire to propose Christ to the world.
Okay.
And so in that way, I can say in basically serving the people of God. Right. That's another way of saying serving the people of God is that, okay, I'm proposing Christ to them, shepherding them, pastoring them. However, it also corresponded to my own deeply, like it responded to my own heart in the sense of what I was desiring was the fact that I perceived the priesthood in my own life to be the answer, or the answer meaning like just like the fulfillment of my own humanity. And that it's not just this thing that I do because it's a good thing. Cause I don't think that's a sufficient reason to be a priest because it's just a good thing to do. I think that there's gotta be something else included in that equation. Because what you'll risk doing is just willing your way into it, right? Without letting Christ speak to you about how he made you, what he wants of you. And anyway, so for me, like I had this deep attraction to when I said, this is my method of happiness. It's another way of saying this is the method by which Christ wants to answer my human need for happiness and fulfillment. And it also means at the same time that he wants to use my life, my flesh, in order to propose him, to proclaim his name to the world, and to feed the people, right, through my own life. And I had a desire for both of those things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So.
Okay. So, talk a little bit about formation. What happens when you...
Ooh. Yeah.
So... Yeah.
Formation, dude. It's like, how do I say it? Like the, without being offensive.
Try me.
First off, like, you know, each house of formation, each seminary is radically different. Some are better than others. Also, sometimes your personality is better suited to one place or another, and that you can't affect. Anyway, so I think that, especially towards the end of my time at the seminary, at the end of 8 years of being a seminarian, being a man in formation for the priesthood, I came to realize that in as much as the church is a conglomerate or is a human thing as well, on top of being, divinely sustained and ordained to exist. In as much as it's human, the seminary itself is a human action. And so therefore it has all the human dynamics included within it. And mm-hmm. I finally accepted that towards the end of my time in seminary. So I got super chill about how broken it can be. I'm like, great. I'm just part of another family. Right. Which means this is not going to be perfect. And I have to have mercy. I have to have a lot of mercy for the men who are in charge of me.
Okay.
But anyway, I would say this, my experience in the seminary has been, one of like massive growth, for several reasons. One is that I believe that God's will, which is his love, his desire, the providence of God, works in every circumstance, whether he willed it or not, right? Whether he would have, whether he allowed something that was bad to happen or whether he, providentially put something in my way that was good.
Okay.
And so what I came to learn in the seminary was, and also because I was involved, again, I was involved in a movement of the church, I learned what it was to be both a human and a Christian and to be a Christian human. A Christianized human, that Christ is meant to answer my heart. And that means that I have to have repentance, humility. I have to, a desire to be an explicit relationship with him, that I have to take seriously the people he gives me in my life. Right. Like, so there's that jerk seminarian down the hall that I don't like.
Mm-hmm.
I predominantly did not like a lot of seminarians that I had met initially. I just like, God, these guys are nerdy. And I'm like, I can't even hold a conversation with you. But they were young. They were young, and I was young and stupid and arrogant, too. But,
I'm old and stupid and arrogant, so it gives you something to look forward to.
There's hope for us all. Anyway. But nonetheless, whether I like it or not, God gave this man to me mm-hmm. to be my friend. And I have to take that dead serious, which is why I love being Catholic, because, well, anyway, that formed me a lot.
Okay.
Right? Being with these dudes and learning what I was learning about philosophy and theology, prayer, charity, simply on the level of friendship and relationship,
mm-hmm.
Really changed me. And so I can say after 8 years of seminary, I'm more human. I'm more myself. It's easier for Christ to work with me because I'm more aware of, you know, not only what's going on in my heart, what I'd really desire, what my weaknesses are, but also the fact that I'm more aware, I'm more attuned to how he works.
Okay.
And so, you know, I mean, but then again, you know, there's also the fact that like, you know, seminary education is difficult. There's only so much they can do with that, you know, and, I heard somebody say on a podcast recently that U.S. seminary formation is just atrocious. Well, I don't know. I mean, maybe. I mean, it just depends on what your standard is, and you can probably give me a million examples of crappy priests. Mm-hmm. But, you know, and maybe there's a generational difference. I'm sure. Well, there is, you know. But even now, it's like there's no way that this is going to be perfect. And that if I want it to be perfect, I'm not really looking for Christ. And that I have to trust that Christ works through these imperfections and that the church is indestructible and that it will exist until the eschaton.
Right.
So, yeah. So I learned what it meant to be human and to be a Christian. And I learned what it meant to allow Jesus to work in my existence so that he could work with me through the sacrament of holy orders. So.
Okay. Just for my own curiosity, what kind of classes do you take at seminary?
Man, each seminary, there's a basic kind of bone, you know, skeletal structure of what every seminary would be learning.
Okay.
So, but each seminary will differ very greatly in what other things they offer. But,
There are electives, and then there's like core curriculum.
Yeah, there's core curriculum that's going to be almost like standard throughout the entire world.
Right.
Right. These are going to include scripture classes,
okay.
Both Old and New Testament, and different parts of the Old and New Testament.
Right? Okay.
It's going to include the nature of Christ,
so
Christology.
Okay.
What has God revealed about the human person? So, also moral theology, both in normal circumstances, but also in the sexual realm.
Okay.
It's going to include ecclesial history. It's going to include sacramental theology, so understanding the sacraments.
Okay.
Liturgical theology, understanding the nature of the liturgy and its fullness.
Because you're going to be doing that a lot.
Yep. And then there's practical classes like how to preach, so homiletics is what it's called.
Okay.
And then there's some pastoral classes about how not to be a jerk with people, basically.
Yeah, okay, I can see that. I can see that.
Yeah, sometimes I think people would do well with I think if there's only one suggestion I would have for U.S. seminary system, whatever that means, is like before a man enters a pastoral class about how to be, how to be a good pastoral presence, whatever, be kind to people, you know, they just need to ask the man like one scenario and have him respond to that scenario the best he can in that moment. And if that guy comes off like a total jerk, then you totally take the class in a different direction for this one man.
Okay.
And then you tell him, hey, you're a jerk.
You're a jerk. Well, you know, I got to say, I mean, for, I mean, I've been a Catholic for, it's going to be 30 years, the end of the year here. And, one of the things that has really struck me is that in all that time, I think I can probably count on less than one hand the number of times I have had a really appalling time in the confessional with a priest who clearly had like zero social skills, right? So whoever's teaching that stuff seems to be doing a good job.
Yeah, I mean, that's actually a really good reality check for me, because the other thing I've been learning as a new priest is the fact that being a priest amongst other priests can be difficult. We're not generally merciful to each other. Mm-hmm. It's a real effort,
right,
to be charitable, and that it's something that I think that most priests do have on their radar. It's like, how do I be loving and charitable to my brothers?
Right.
And you know, because you know, I mean, it's just like any other kind of environment. You know, there is a lot of insider ball, and you know, you get lost in the details, and
right,
you know, if you had a stressful week. Which is most priest weeks are stressful. So.
Right, yeah. Oh, yeah, this is why I have such a high regard for priests. I mean, you know, if it were my job to, like, spend week after week sitting in a little box listening to people come in and, you know, just this endless litany of human failure, you know, I would go insane having to listen all the time, you know? And I remember talking to a priest one time about this, and I don't know if you can confirm or deny this, but, you know, I said, how do you endure that? He says, I think it's the grace of the sacrament. And he says, I'll tell you the truth, and this is really the truth. He says, I can't remember a word people have said to me once I walk out of that confessional. He says, if you could put me under oath, I wouldn't be lying to say I don't remember anything that people tell me. You know, it's just, it's gone. It goes, you know, when it's absolved, it goes away. It's gone. And if God has forgotten it, you know,
yeah,
forget it, you know.
For me, so far, I mean, maybe it's the fact that I'm a new priest, and everything is so fresh. Like, you know, it's like, I still remember what I hear, right? But the weird thing for me is that I just don't care, right? Like, in the sense that I am not scandalized by anything.
Okay.
Just like,
that's good.
You know, like, oh, great, you killed a guy. Well, that's a really not a good thing. And, but it's like, okay, but you're also, you happen to be a homo sapien and you did a bad thing, and I'm just okay. Welcome to being a human.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, it's like, I don't remember them when I see people. It just doesn't really come up on my radar as something to think about.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, I see what you're saying. Yeah.
It's more like, if I see a person outside of the confessional, all I remember is that I had a human conversation with them where something beautiful happened.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, like, and that's... Yeah. That was the other thing that another priest told me. He says, what I remember about people is not their sins. He says, what, you know, especially with face-to-face confession, he has really enjoyed it because people, after they have had their sins absolved, really just, he says, that's what you remember is their face. You know,
yeah.
This is somebody who's had their sins forgiven, and they are a new person, you know?
Yeah.
And that's that is something where I think I would love to be able to be a priest to see that.
Yeah, I think also for me, like, honestly, the most surprising fact for me is the people who are like just like totally out of my league, right? Like, I'll have people come into confession, and like, these are exceptionally holy individuals, you know, and I'll just be like, they'll confess some stuff, and I'll be like, wow, well, here's a Hail Mary. I'll literally say to people, this is out of my league.
Hmm.
Your penance is a Hail Mary. because it's just like that. And I'll suggest, like, I think you should get a spiritual director because, you know, I want you to be fed, and directed in this, because obviously Jesus is deeply working in your existence and you're saying yes to him really well. And yeah. You know, and that's the reason why I'm saying, God, this is out of my league, you know, and I just got to be humble in front of that.
Yeah. Yeah. So. Yeah. I had a friend one time who was received into the church, and he was kind of a jokey sort of guy. He'd been an Anglican, and, you know. And he said, you know, he had been raised to believe in the four pillars of Anglicanism, which were, what was it? Three of them were golf, scotch, and tax. Oh, that was it. The 1928 prayer book, golf, scotch, and tax-free municipal bonds. And those are his four pillars of Anglicanism. And he was, you know, he was a funny guy, you know. And the day he was received into the church, he went to confession.
Mm-hmm.
And he had kidded, you know, for months about being, he was going to be a good Episcopalian Catholic and all the rest of it. And he walked out of confession. And it was profound, you know. Mm-hmm. And somebody made some, you know, joking comment to him after he came out of confession. You know, how's our Episcopalian? And he looked at them very seriously, and he said, "I am a Catholic."
Mm.
And wow. He was deeply moved by that experience of confession. It took a huge weight off of him. And I've had other, and it had that effect on me as well. The first time I ever went to confession was a revolution for me to discover, because I had people come up to me afterwards. I seemed to attract like lapsed Catholics after I entered the church, and I had all these people come up to me who were like lapsed Catholics, and they were all like, "I hate the sacrament of confession. It makes me feel so guilty." And my response was, "Dude, I was raised nothing, and I could tell you all about guilt." What was awesome was, you know, if I had known that there was such a thing, it's where you could walk in and you could just dump all of this crap that you've been carrying around, you know, your whole life. And when it was done, the priest wasn't going to look at you and say, "You disgust me." You know,
I'm laughing because it's so absurd. That image is so absurd.
Yeah, but you know, that's the fear. Of course, if people do the things that I have done, they wouldn't. No one would ever speak to me again. And instead of that, what happens is, by the grace of God, you know, because it's not the priest talking to you; it's Jesus talking to you.
Yeah, exactly.
Give everything that you have confessed. Nothing but mercy for you. And here, have some grace so that when you walk out of here, you're going to be better than you were when you came in. You're not going to just be forgiven. Wow. Marvel.
I think, actually, Mark, you're hitting on, like, for me, like, a really particular, you're giving me some vocabulary right now from my own experience. Again, being in the fog of being a baby priest, you don't always have words for your experience yet. But I think, like, the experience for me is that these people come in, and there's something in me that's, like, different, right? I notice, like, a difference in my disposition, number one. Uh-huh. Two is that, like, you know, like, these people tell me this stuff, right? And all I could think, you know, all that makes me feel is the same feeling I have when I first meet somebody. I think, I want to get a beer with this person. And it's not – and then you want to be able to, like there's something inside of you, like this is Jesus saying, I want to be able to lighten this person's load, and they're interesting to me. right? Not in a morbid or sick kind of way. Like, I want to hear the juicy details stuff. It's not that. It's like that, wow, this person is really open to the Lord. They're here. They're here in the confessional. That's like almost perfect definition of being open to the Lord at this day and age. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and it's just like, here's this human being who's experiencing transformation. Let's get a beer. Like, if that's Jesus working with my personality, you know, but in some ways, but
yeah,
I would never ask that's totally inappropriate to say that in the confessional, but anyway.
So so you were ordained, when were you ordained? It wasn't too long ago.
4 months ago.
4 months? Why, you're just a baby priest.
Mm-hmm.
So what's what have you learned since becoming a priest?
Oh, man. Besides what I said in the beginning, I think the other things that I've learned have been I feel that the possibility of someone becoming more humanly happy because they're more intensely in relationship with Christ, aka holiness,
mm-hmm.
is even more of a real possibility to me now than it was before.
Okay.
That holiness actually is possible.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, I am also learning way more faults about myself than I was ever aware of in some ways, like, and not in like a beat myself up, self-loathing kind of way, just more of like, hey, oh, Jesus didn't want, like, is now opening that dark closet in my heart, wanting to take a peek in there. I didn't even know that one existed. And that's actually pretty liberating. It's really helpful to play the fool.
Okay.
That, you know, it's okay for me to not know what the hell's going on, right? And not know what to do.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I don't know, that he's very, very, very potent. He can do anything, right? Jesus can do anything. And I am more and more convinced of that even after ordination than I was even before.
Okay.
My friends had a running bet going before ordination. They said that if Colin gets ordained, God exists. So.
Okay. So have they asked for baptism now? Is that
I've been starting joking with them every time I see them at Mass. I'm like, it's good to see you've returned to the sacraments.
Very good. Very good. Well, I'm going to have to pop over to St. Luke's for confession again one of these days. I've been sort of winding up in different places depending on how long the line is. Or one time, the first time I went to confession with you, I went to a parish and there was this huge long line. And it was like, if I wait, he's going to like stop because he's got to go say Mass. So I'm just leaving now. So I just got in the car and I thought, where else might there be a place? I know, I'll go to St. Luke's. And that's how I wound up going to you for confession that one time. And you were good, by the way, which is why I'm going to come back to you.
Awesome.
So you're a good confessor.
Thank you. So, I
try. All right. That's good. Well, I want to thank you so much for being on Connecting the Dots today. And you know, blessings on your priesthood. And we'll come back, you know, in a year or something and get the next update from you on how things are going or something like that.
Yeah. And also, Mark, can I make a plug? Can I make a shameless plug?
Make a shameless plug. Go right ahead.
Awesome. Yeah. You know, there's the director of evangelization over here at St. Luke's and I.
Tony, are we talking about Tony Vicinda?
We are.
We have had Tony on the show. He's the beard balm guy for those of you out there in Connecting the Dots land.
Yeah, and then, by the way, you know I work with your son?
I believe I knew something vaguely to that effect.
Okay.
What do you guys do exactly? I don't even know.
It was Tony, sorry.
Okay.
Your son Cal was a different thing. Anyway, I wanted to make a shameless plug for Tony and I's podcast called The Threshold Podcast. It's where we do these conversations basically according to kind of what Sherry Waddell laid out as far as threshold conversations in her book for Special Disciples. And it's a way of speaking to people, both Christians and non-Christians alike, about what they really believe. And, you know, because of the climate of the Northwest, the cultural climate, that's like a super taboo thing to do. And so, but it's like the most important thing for us as humans is to understand what each other believe. So we're basically just trying to develop trust with everybody and just helping maybe show people what it means to have an awesome, honest conversation about what this other person believes. So, I would just really invite anybody to listen to our podcast. Where our next episode coming out this week is actually with Brandon Vaught. He's a good guy. Yeah. But my plug is not just really to listen. It's more like if you have anybody that you know that is a non-Christian that would like to talk to two, semi-normal dudes who are just kind of hilarious guys, just about belief, what you believe, and you're a non-Christian, your friend's a non-Christian, or you're a non-Christian, you know, go to the Threshold Podcast on Facebook,
right?
And just message us, because we're really looking for new friends that are not, you know, that we can interview and talk to and kind of get to know you.
Excellent.
So,
yes, absolutely. Yeah. All right. Well, you've been listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. Today we've been talking to Father Colin Parrish, baby priest at St. Luke's Catholic Church in Seattle, in Shoreline, Washington. And so if you're ever in Seattle or in the Shoreline area, you can go and meet Father Colin Parrish in the flesh if you want. We will be back on Connecting the Dots next time. Until then, thanks for listening, and bye-bye.